We are in Genesis chapter 1. Last week we went through chapters 2 and 3 and covered the second creation account, the account which dealt more specifically and directly with the creation of humans and our place in God's creation, and the understanding or the approach that we have to the issue of the fall, to the introduction of sin into the world. So today, now that we've done that and looked at the second creation account, the second, and when I say the second, I mean the second one to be found in the Bible, we're going to go back and look at the first creation account. And there is a reason why I did it in this order. The first creation account is written after the second, but it comes before in the canonical order. And there's a way that we know that. Well, there are several ways that we know that. For one thing, vocabulary used by in Genesis 1 is a more advanced Hebrew vocabulary than what you find in 2 and 3. It reflects some Babylonian words that have been Hebraicized, some Assyrian words that have been Hebraicized, and some concepts that, in terms of philosophical concepts, that are highly advanced and depend upon those other societies' worldview. And we'll hit those in a moment when we read through this. Whereas chapters 2 and 3 is a far more primitive form of Hebrew with no additives from the Babylonian and the Assyrian world, but with some Egyptian-rooted Hebraicized words. So chapter 2 and 3 are more primitive, older than chapter 1. And so some conservative Old Testament scholars assign 2 and 3's creation story to Moses as the proximate author of all of Genesis. And chapter 1 is the work of an editor who went back through, and you can trace his editorial work throughout the book of Genesis. In fact, you can trace his editorial work throughout the whole Torah, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. You can trace this editor's work throughout the entire collection of the Torah. It's the same basic author or authors who have gone through and made editorial comments, have cleaned up some interesting vocabulary issues, have made certain, those editorial comments are things like, and that is the reason why to this day such and such happens. Those little aside remarks come out of place, but they knit stories together. And so what many scholars say, conservative Old Testament scholars will say, is that Moses wrote the older stuff, and then an editor came along and did some editorial work to smooth it out and knit it all together into what we know of today as the Torah, and appended to the front of it this creation account, which is far more expansive, far more philosophical and general than the specific creation account found in chapters 2 and 3.
I have a question that I meant to ask last week.
Yes.
Is it likely that the second version,
yes,
that's actually the first, would have started with verse 4 where it says, "This is the history of the heavens and the earth as they were created"?
If you take a look at the version that we looked at last week, the second creation account, it starts at verse 4. The first creation account goes through chapter 2, verse 3. Remember, chapters and verses come later, much later, as in within the last 1,000 years of the transmission of the scriptures. Chapters and verses are a very late addition to the communication, transmission of the Bible. They are for our convenience. Therefore, just because a chapter division occurs at a certain spot doesn't mean it necessarily belongs there. And in fact, in many cases, it does not. Likewise, sometimes verse divisions ruin the sense of a passage. And you have to take the verses out, the verse numbers and divisions out, and read it straight through to get the full idea. So you got to be careful with the verses in chapters. Just because a chapter is divides a story in a certain way, or the versification divides up sentences in a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's correct. So just keep that in mind. The first creation account found in Scripture, the canonical first creation account, goes from chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3. The second one is chapter 2, verse 4 and following. We covered that last time. No reason why we can't go back and look at that again, and eventually, someday, but not tonight, we will. Tonight, our objective is to start looking at the first one. Now, we were able to read through chapters 2 and 3 in about an hour and 20 minutes and reviewed them and talked about them at length. We're not going to spend that long tonight, and we're not going to get as far tonight, I don't think. Even though we have less material to go through, we have some dense material to go through. So let's begin in chapter 1, verse 1. Now, I assume we have some multiple different translations in here, so that's good. I have several in front of me, including the Hebrew. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. That's the beginning. That's the beginning in Hebrew. And it never hurts just to hear it, to remember that this was written not in English, not in Greek, not in German or Russian, but in God's language, Hebrew. Hear that first sentence again. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, or possibly, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, or when God began creating the heavens and the earth. Lots of different possible alternative translations can be come up with here. First of all, Elohim is plural, the formal identity, God's label, Elohim, gods. All right? But it is usually translated with the singular God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths. And the Spirit of God was fluttering, hovering over the surface of the waters. That's my rough translation from the Hebrew. In the NRSV it reads, "The earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the surface of the waters."
So the Spirit of God is wind?
It's the same word in Hebrew. It's also the same word for breath. Wind, breath, the motion of air. The Hebraic understanding of the Holy Spirit is that feeling when you do this. When you wave in your face and you feel that air flowing on you. That insubstantial yet real, tellable feeling. That's kind of their idea of what the Holy Spirit is like. Breath, wind, air, the Spirit, and it hovers or floats or flutters kind of over the surface of the waters. Notice, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a flat-out statement, period. Now, you could continue on. I'm looking at this Hebrew here, and in the Hebrew, there is no reason why this has to be the end of the sentence, except that the scribe used the end of the sentence consonantal form for haaretz. Doesn't necessarily have to be that way. The NRSV continues on in verse 2 after a comma. Other translations, like the NAS, put a period after earth. So it could be a simple declaratory statement. A simple statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Period. He created the heavens and the earth. The whole thing. Done. Not process. A completed fact. God created the heavens and the earth. done. Now that, to me, is just a fantastic statement right there. All these arguments over how God created it, what kind of days there were, whether or not they were days at all, how long they may have lasted, did God use evolution, what kind of evolution, did God create by voice, did God create by molding stuff, all that stuff, what order did he create it in, all that stuff can be simply bypassed by looking at verse 1 and saying, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Done. And by heavens and the earth, that's everything. Yes. Beyond what you can see at night, beyond what can be seen with the best instrumentation, beyond the physical, because heavens, Hashemayim, the heavens, is not just the sky, although that's part of it. It's everything that is not Haaretz, the earth. Hashemayim is all that stuff, absolutely everything up in the sky, and everything that is beyond the everything up there in the sky, i.e., all the spiritual realms, what we think of as heaven, heaven, heaven. Hashemayim, the heavens, the things that are not Haaretz, the earth. All right? So, in verse 1, you have the entire creation story, if Cliff Note version, maybe.
Unless you have the Youngs.
Read the Youngs.
Youngs says, in the beginning of God's preparing the heavens and the earth.
Interesting. Now that is sort of takes the idea that verse 1 is not a declaratory sentence, but the beginning of a longer sentence that continues with verse 2, as in the NRSV's version, where it says, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, and a wind from God swept over the surface of the waters. Yes.
The way you phrased it just now, as not a declarative sentence, but as part of a longer sentence. The beginning when God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was a formless void. The way I read that, the heavens, we used to say the heavens is a vastness.
Yes.
The earth in that first statement, I don't think of as earth. I think of everything that's solid.
Okay.
That throughout the universe.
Okay.
And then the earth, our earth,
yes,
was a shapeless void.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea. And it follows from the idea that verse 1 is the beginning of the sentence, but not a total sentence, a simple sentence in and of itself. And yet that doesn't necessarily even conflict with the idea that verse 1 stands on its own. The heavens and the earth. Now, what's important to the Hebrew people? The earth. It's where they live. And what you're going to get here in chapter 1 is a description of the creation of that thing, the Haaretz, its structure, its form, its establishment in all of its many varied natures and structures, its peopling or populating with animals and humans. But not just the Haaretz, but things up in the Hashemayim, in the sky. The stars and the planets and the moon and the sun itself, all of the features of the sky that are visible to Hebrew people are given a place and a purpose in the creation account here in chapter 1. If he begins by saying, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, period, end of story, then what follows is one of two things, possibly more than one of two, but I'll present two possibilities. Firstly, it is now an unpacking of that verse. And this is what it means to say that God created the Hashemayim and the Haaretz, the heavens and the earth. Or, it's a statement of the recreation of the heavens and the earth.
Recreation?
Yes, because the next sentence is a very interesting one. The phrase in the NRSV reads, the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep. One possible translation reads, "Now the earth was formless and empty." But it could be as easily in Hebrew translated as, "Now the earth became." The "was" statement. Hayata was. Hayata. It can mean more than just is or was. It could be translated, "Now the earth at that point in time is formless and empty." All right? Not today, but at that time. So we would say was. But it can also mean literally, and in some context does mean, not necessarily here, but elsewhere where it's used in the Hebrew Bible, became. "Now the earth became formless and empty, and darkness covered the surface of the watery deeps."
That earth hath existed waste and void.
The earth hath existed waste and void. Which translation is that?
Young's.
That word is a hard one. Hayata means was. Used in the right context could be is, but past tense. Could be became. Could be translated became. Hence, "Now the earth became formless and empty, and darkness covered the surface of the watery depths."
What would it have been before it became?
Whatever it was. Whatever it had been in God's creation. And then it got wiped out. It got damaged. It got destroyed. And there are Hebrew interpretations, Jewish interpretations of Genesis, which state that what we have in verses 2 and following is a story of the recreation of the earth. And there's a reason for that.
Assume that God didn't get it right the first time, so we tried a second?
Not that God got it wrong, but that something screwed it up.
Now look at the flood.
Mm-hmm. Look at the flood.
Well, it took a man to do that.
Well, same thing. Something may have happened which destroyed the earth. Who has a King James? I want you to read Genesis chapter 1, verse 28.
"And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it."
Thank you.
"And have dominion over the fish of the sea."
That's it. That was what I was looking for.
Replenish.
Replenish. Now, that's an old translation. Most modern translations say fill it. But the old translation reflects both a Greek interpretation from the Septuagint as well as a concept or an idea contained in the Hebrew. Verse 28. Mil'o, and refill. The idea is you can't replenish something unless it was first plenished. And to plenish is an old English word which means to fill up. To replenish means to refill it. You replenish your stocks only after they have been depleted. And it's refilled, literally. Now, that doesn't make any sense if this is the creation story and there hasn't been an original filling. But some Hebrew scholars, some Jewish scholars say that what we have in verse 2 and following is a reconstruction of an earth and a heavens that have been destroyed. Now, that destruction, some say, is the result of the fall of Satan. That God had created the heavens and the earth. It included angelic realms and all of the heavenly hosts. And when Satan fell, it destroyed the heavens and the earth. It laid them waste, and they became a waste and a desolation. And so now God has to start over and rebuild it. Now that's an interesting interpretation. Because it means then that between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 could be a very vast period of time. Now, do I say that there is a gap between 1:1 and 1:2? I don't know. But it makes sense about the language to replenish or to fill up again, as the Hebrew would say. If it's not that, then it certainly is an unpacking of the creation statement in verse 1:1, if we understand verse 1:1 as standing on its own. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. All right. So we have the creation account in one verse, in one sentence, and then what follows is what that creation was. That would also fit with Hebraic poetry and Hebraic prophecy. In Hebraic prophecy, the prophet will tell you what he's going to tell you in short form. He'll then tell you in a much more expanded version, and then he'll give you a follow-up conclusion. That's good teaching practice anyway. You tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. Mm-hmm. All right? So we kind of have that if that's an understanding here. I don't really care. No matter how you understand it, this is God's creation of what we see here today in verses 2 and following. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery deeps. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. It's an interesting situation. The earth is formless and void. What does that mean? Empty. Empty means void. Formless. What do you think that means?
Wasn't finished.
A great big mess.
It's a blob.
That's a blob. Yeah. That's kind of the idea. A great big soggy muddy blob.
Like a lava lamp.
Kinda. That's sort of flowing, kind of bubbly. Blech. Or, to use the scientific favorite today, the primordial soup. Ugh, not Campbell's. All right. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths. If you didn't have any kind of form, how do you have watery depths? If you don't have oceans, how do you have watery depths?
Atmosphere.
If you don't have heavens and earth, sky, and everything in between, how do you have atmosphere? Might the phrase watery depths, surface of the watery depths, be more poetic?
Mine says face of the deep.
Face of the deep. Might that be... Now, the deep in Hebrew thought is a place of mystery. The Hebrew people were not ocean-going people, friends. They were afraid of water. They had acute argophobia, and they didn't like getting close to great big bodies of water. They'd sail out on the Sea of Galilee. They'd sail down the Jordan River. But I think going through the Red Sea had a really bad impact on them. Walking through it, they saw the Leviathan swimming on either side, and it terrified them. And they were afraid of the deep. And they equated, therefore, in their imagery, and you see this in the Psalms, they equate in their imagery, in their poetic imagery, the deep with anything that is unknown and chaotic, and hence not really the realm of God's rulership. And God is fluttering over it in the image here. So don't think so much literal at this point. Think more figurative. The created order, God has whatever, and now he's going to start dividing and separating to create structure. But it begins as a great, great big blob of nothing.
It's going to bring order out of chaos.
Yes. With the Holy Spirit, God's presence, the breath of God, floating around.
The mighty wind.
In it. The mighty wind. Floating around, getting ready to do stuff. Now look what he first creates. Now you've got all this mess, this soggy, icky mess. Then God said, let there be light. Just as simple as that. Light be. Literally. Light come into being. And there was light. And light was. You know, bango. From nothing. Creation ex nihilo. Creation from absolutely nothing. There was no light. And suddenly, there's light. Coming from where? From him, yes. From his statement, let there be light. But what's its source? Well, his word, his creative genius, his, as we said last time, his logos. He has created light from nothing. But normally, light that comes from light exists, yes, but it has a physical, visible source. Here we just see light appearing out of nowhere. And suddenly filling the void with light. But with no distinct pinpoint source other than his word. Interesting.
Same thing in Jerusalem. There's no day. There's no night.
Yeah, there's only day.
There's no sun, there's no moon.
There's just day.
There's just light from him.
Light from him. Light from him. And it's filling everything. It's not coming from a sun. It's not coming from a star. It's not coming from a big bang. It's simply there. Well, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. So he creates light, and then he, by separating the light, generates darkness. That's interesting. He creates darkness by separating out light from it.
Darkness is the absence of light.
Yes, by philosophical principle, darkness is the absence of light.
But it's not the other way around.
No, it's not. Darkness is not a positive. It is an absence. It's a lack.
It can't be a positive.
It cannot be.
Correct. That's correct. In and of itself, you can't fill something up with darkness in this sense. Now, you can in a philosophical sense if you understand darkness as being evil. But right now, it's neither good nor evil. It simply is. He's pronounced the light being good thus far. Let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. So, what was there before he said, let there be light?
It said darkness covered the surface of the watery depths.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Darkness, light, and then he recreates, in a sense, by separating out the light. You notice, God's creation is a process. A progressive step in increase, and we're going to see that, in increasing stages of complexity. All right? In what many people identify as logical sequential steps, almost necessary steps.
Intelligent design?
Yes, intelligent design. The idea that the universe is created with form and structure and a purpose and meaning can be divined from it.
Not only intelligent, he achieved the impossible. As you just said, you cannot create a positive from a negative.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that darkness is nothing. Darkness is a not.
Uh-huh.
And you cannot get
a positive from a negative.
A positive from a not. Something from nothing.
Or you can't create substance without substance.
God just did.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly.
God just did. God saw the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. Evening came, and then morning, the first day. Interesting. Evening, and then morning, the first day. The Hebrew reckoning of time is always from sundown to sundown. It is now Monday on the Hebrew calendar because it's dark outside. It's not still Sunday to them. It's now Monday to them. They go from sundown to sundown in reckoning time. The evening and the morning, the first day. But this has nothing to do with time references, nothing to do with hours, minutes, and seconds, or how we reckon the passage of time, because we reckon the passage of time based upon structures within the creation that are not here yet.
That was going to be my question. Isn't evening and day typically the turning based on the turn
yes,
of the earth?
That's our experience of it now. But at this point in time, he has light zones and dark zones. Zones where there are light and zones where there is dark. The zones where there is light is day, and the zones where it's dark is night. And you've got evening and you've got morning and you've got one day. Now, I tend to agree with the understanding that this is that day ought to be the first step of creation, the first stage of creation, where he begins by saying light be and light is and it's good, and then he separates it to identify the difference between light days and dark nights. But before there's a sun, before there's a planet, really, yet there's no continents, nothing.
So it's time without passage.
It's existence without time. And yet the terminology of time has to be used because human beings cannot conceive of existence without time. We can't. We think in hours, minutes, and seconds. Days, months, and years. Decades, centuries, and millennia. But humans can't think beyond millennia because we don't live beyond centuries. But we know about the accumulation of centuries from all the people who've lived through history, hence we can conceive of a millennium, 1,000 years. But beyond that time of reckoning, we cannot understand. And yet we know that God has no trouble conceiving of such ideas. He's God. So right now we're dealing with an idea of existence without time. There's no way to measure it by human standards. None. I don't believe in the days in creation story being literal 24-hour days. Certainly not yet. Now, they may become that at some point. But right now, there's no way to determine that, frankly, one way or the other. Hence, I prefer to assume we're talking about timeless existence.
Well, if a day is measured, and not time-wise measured, but is measured by the existence of dark and light,
yes,
isn't what you have by separating the two and having them available a day?
Yes, exactly. In existence, but not in duration. A day exists, like if you had a painting or a chart, and you have your light section and your dark section, you say that is your day. Not a time period, but a simple is, a simple existence. Yes, exactly. These are the components of a day.
Right. Our day is determined by the rotation. You know, it's mm-hmm. not really the sun rising, it's
right.
the turning. Whereas in the beginning,
there wasn't any of that yet.
Light here for long, you know, for some period, and dark over here for some period.
As we said in the second creation story last week, the time in the garden is entirely indeterminate. We don't know how long passed. It could have been millions of years that Adam and Eve lived in the garden without eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We don't know how long they lived there. We don't. It does not say. It is entirely indeterminate with that regards to that question. Likewise, we don't know what kind of passage of time there could have been there, if any. And I don't think there is a passage of time at this point, because time is frankly an expression of human experience. We don't got that yet. Either human experience directly or by extrapolation, what we observe. Then God said, verse 6, then God said, let there be an expanse between the waters, separating water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above the expanse. And it was so. Wouldn't it be great just to be able to just do, you know, just simply, and it be so?
And I've never understood this part.
The expanse?
The firmament and dividing the waters above and below.
Well, you have to understand the Hebraic view of the universe. They view the universe as the as everything that is above the earth, and the earth as essentially a flat plain with mountains around the exterior, and there's a dome, a hard structured dome sitting above it with water floating above it, and rain is when the fountains, when the windows of the sky are opened and water falls through, and then there's water underneath the earth. And they know that because they get it out of wells.
Right.
There's water underneath the earth that comes up in oceans and seas and rivers and springs and wells. So you got water above and water sitting on the surface, of course, and water below.
I never did comprehend the water above except as rain.
Yeah, and that's how they know about it, in the form of rain falling from the sky.
So it has to come from a water source up there.
Yes. Now, we know that this is the Hebraic view of the universe because such diagrams were drawn by people on caves and other places in literature. They describe the universe just as this, in this way.
They were scared to fall off the edge.
And if you take a look at the universe, go outside and take a look around. It's what it looks like. It looks like a great big dome above your head. In the day, you can't see the lights of the sky, but at night you can. We're going to find out about that, too, in just a moment. But the first step was to create light and then to divide it out from darkness so that you have night and day. The second step is to, all this watery, slushy mass, let's make some order and structure from that. So let's separate it. Now, I find it fascinating because the Hebrew uses this language. But I find it interesting. How do you have above and below without gravity and without a planetary body?
Without form.
If you are in space, in orbit around the Earth, in a microgravity environment, things floating around in the space shuttle, there is no up and down. There simply is. You separate things apart, you go, so you float around, but there is no up and down. All up and down features are a structure of what we know living in a gravity environment. And yet they use the terminology above and below based upon what's going to come next. All right? So it's anticipating the next steps in creation. All right? So now what he does is he creates a gap in the middle of this meshy, slushy, material and watery, ugh. All right. He creates this gap in the middle, a pocket, if you will, of air. And that's what this is, this expanse, this firmament. The firmament is, the Hebrew word is raki'a, which means literally opening with a hard covering over it.
I have a note that says that the Hebrew word for expanse is from a root meaning to spread out, stamp. Firmly.
Exactly.
Which suggests something like a dome.
A dome. A beat out surface, like a shield, but it's beat out opening and a hard shell over it, like a bowl flipped over. And it's beaten out like out of metal. The Hebrew word literally means that. But it's not just a flat surface like a shield so much as a curved surface because it has a gap inside it. An opening inside of it, a volume suddenly. We now have space. God's terrarium. And God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above the expanse. So now he's moved the waters apart. We've got water underneath the opening, the gap area within that shield or dome, and then we've got water above it. All right? And it was so. And God called the expanse sky. That area within there and that surface above it, that hard surface. And you've got evening and you've got morning the second day. Day two comes, and it's actually stage of creation two, is how I prefer to think of it. And you now have not just light with night and day, but you've got a volume, space, which he's called sky, with a surface called sky. You got water above it, you got water underneath it. Then God said, let the water under the sky, within and underneath the firmament, be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. So now he extrudes from the mass, the lump of whatever, all the water, and he puts it in one place. Now, think about it. You're Hebrew. You live in Israel. Israel is located at one end of the Mediterranean Sea. And that's the biggest body of water that you personally know. That's the one place. Now you can say all seas and all oceans are that one place. Two. Because the creation story, and that's true throughout most, in fact all of Genesis, reflects the experience of the Hebrew people in the universe as they knew it within the boundaries of their knowledge of it. All right? So it's all in one place now. All the waters are in one spot. And land appears. And it was so. I just love that. God called the dry land Aretz, earth. God called the dry land earth. And he called the gathering of the water seas. And God saw that it was good.
I know there's a nest on seas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would mean that they would think that there, or realize there's more than one?
That there, yes. That there, well, they would even know it in their own experience, because you got the Sea of Galilee, and you got the Mediterranean Sea, and you got the Red Sea. But they're all part of the same thing, the sea, the waters, which are connected to the waters below. The land's on pillars, and the waters below kind of make their way out at the openings where there are seas.
Probably looks a whole lot like some of the steam rooms that you
have. Yeah, a lot like steam rooms, where you have this level, and then you have these pillars underneath it, and you have bubbling water going underneath to generate a warm floor and steam up the sides. Yeah. Exactly. Let the water under the sky be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and he called the gathering of the water seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit with seed in it, according to their kinds. And it was so. Notice, thus far, how does God create things?
He said, let it be.
He says them, and they are. Let it be. Let there be vegetation, and there is. Just bang. Isn't that wonderful? Not the result of war, not the result of conflict, not the result of sex. In the ancient world, in the Babylonian world, in the Assyrian world, in the Philistine world, in the Egyptian world, the universe is the result of war amongst the gods, of sex between the gods, of accidents that occur amongst the gods. It's the result of what we would think of as almost common everyday things. I mean, there's the Babylonian creation myth has the great bull of heaven being chopped in half, and one half being used for the earth and one half being used for the sky. That's weird, but that's how they viewed things. This is very different than any other creation story in the ancient world, because it establishes the universe as the purposeful result of God's creative genius, not an accident, not the result of battles or wars, but the purposeful result of God's creative genius. I am creating, and this is what I'm doing. And he goes about it doing certain ways. Thus far, he's gone about it by creating and dividing, separating apart elements that he's created. Let the earth produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit and seed in it, according to their kinds, and it was so. Done. He's created all those things. Doesn't mean that there's not more variation to come in those things, but he's created them. The earth brought forth vegetation. Now notice, the earth brought forth vegetation. Well, plants grow up from the earth, don't they? Of course, there are plants in the waters, in the seas, but the Hebrews have experience with plants on the earth, and they grow up out of the earth. So the earth brought forth vegetation, seed-bearing plants according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit and with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Evening came, and then morning, the third day. Notice the refrain. It was good. 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 God's creation is good. Every step of it is good. All right. Then God said, any questions? Sorry, excuse me. Any questions? God didn't say any questions. Are there any questions at this point?
It would have been just as easy for him to say, let it be.
Yeah.
And have skipped all of these steps.
Sure. We didn't. I mean, he could have created it completely as it was when it was done without having to go on through all these steps.
So is this for our benefit?
It is. You want my opinion on that?
Yeah.
I believe that God did it this way to demonstrate something about God's nature. That God is a God of order and reason. God creates things intentionally. And God does so specifically so that we can experience that order in creation. If you look around, the universe has order and structure to it. It has that intelligent design. And here we see an intelligent designer intentionally going about the creation. And it's being articulated this way by the author specifically to stand this in contradistinction with all the other creation stories that exist in the ancient world. So instead of being the result of conflict, instead of being an accident, instead of being the result of sex between gods, this is a result of a purposeful creation by a creator who's doing this for a specific reason and establishing order and reason and structure. Without this view of the universe that we see in Genesis chapter 1, science would be impossible.
I was going to say, going from back to front, when man started to understand the concept of himself and why we have two lungs, why we have two kidneys, why we do what we do, you can look at the order of a human being as medicine and science developed and go, okay, well, obviously, God designed us the way he designed the universe because it shows in Genesis that it's done the steps. So it makes sense why we're made the way we are and you just follow all the way through.
Yes.
So it was for our benefit.
It was for our benefit in the end. And it's being written this way to say to the ancient world and all of their mythologies of the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Philistines and the Phoenicians and the Greeks and the Romans, look, although they weren't around yet, look, you dum-dums. God did not create the universe as an accident or the result of sex or anything else. God created it purposefully and gave it a structure and an order that can be observed and understood. Not the result of chaos, but the result of intelligence. That makes this creation account totally unlike any other that exists. It's the second one, the earlier creation account, which we have in chapter 2 and following, also shows a purposeful creation, but for different reasons, with specific human-oriented reasons involved. We're not looking at that tonight, but But nevertheless, it's the result of a creative genius of someone doing something for a, of a god, doing this for a specific intelligent purpose, not the result of an accident like all the other religions claim. Human beings are the result of failed, well, if you believe some weirdos, failed alien experiments, or in the ancient world, human beings are the result of gods who have engaged in such practices that has resulted in a production of subspecies of gods, which they eventually become humans. What we have in the creation is the result of God's intelligence, God's intention to create. And that's what the story principally intends to communicate. That God did it with a purpose, with order and structure that can be observed, understood. That's totally different than any other ancient story of creation that exists. None has that type of viewpoint. And it is exactly on this way of thinking and looking at the universe that science becomes possible. Which tells me that in its fundamental structure in nature, science is a creation of God.
And how it could be, how any... the Big Bang, and it happened, and everything's by chance, and we just evolved. Any of that can take hold is beyond me, because this all makes so much sense, and if you look at the order of the universe, it's so glaring.
Well, there are some people who say that the Big Bang is God saying, let there be light, that kind of thing. You know, I used to actually hold that position. I don't necessarily hold it anymore. The Big Bang is the current modern mythology about the creation of the universe, in which they do it in such a way to get around the idea of a deity. It's the materialist approach to the universe. My conclusion for tonight is this, because we're done with the story. We're going to pick it up next week with verse 14. When you're dealing with the creation story in Genesis, you're dealing firstly with a story that tells us about who God is. Secondly, who we are. And thirdly, why we're here. Now, it tells us about the creation, it tells us who did it, it tells us how he did it, but what's most important is what it tells us about who did it. And we learn a lot about God in chapter 1. And when you look at what God created in this universe through natural revelation, i.e. look at the laws of physics and everything else, you see God's fingerprint absolutely everywhere. And what scientists have to do is, those who are scientific materialists, who say there's nothing other than matter, physical things, what they will say is, because there is nothing other than that, there cannot be a deity unless he's matter, unless he's physical. And there is nothing in the universe other than that which you can see and observe, and therefore it had to self-start. Scientific empiricalists look at it and say, what does it show me? A scientific materialist will say, well, it has the appearance of design, it has the appearance of intelligent design behind it and a purpose, but that intelligence is really the intelligence of the person looking at it and not of it itself. Whereas the scientific empiricalist will look at it and say, it has signs of intelligent design. It seems to be a machined thing, created by a creator who had an intention in making it, and they made it in a certain way, and you can learn about that creator from that. That's science in and of itself, but it's empiricalism, i.e. what do you see? That's two approaches, and the world today, scientific world today, is governed by scientific materialism, not empiricalism. And scientific materialism is based on a philosophical principle that's very much a statement of faith. There is nothing other than matter. That separation, that understanding, that difference between scientific materialism and scientific empiricalism can be seen rooted even in this. Those who want to deny the order and structure of the universe will say, well, this is just a myth and it doesn't mean anything. Or it's a description of an order and structure in nature, but not, and of the person looking at it, not of the creator himself. Whereas an empiricalist will say, no, the order and structure of creation points to the Creator who did it, and that's exactly what Genesis 1 does. It points to the Creator who created it. And intelligent design says that an intelligent agent did the creating. And when you look down at the cellular level, inside cells there are little biological molecular machines, very much like a machine in a car or a computer even. And these machines do things, specific things, that are amazing. There's no way it could have come about by accident. They have every single characteristic of designed things. And if you didn't know it was biology, you'd think it was something that a human being had created. And scientific empiricalism, which looks at Genesis 1 and says we can learn about the Creator and who the Creator is from a story like this, describing the structure and order of creation as an intelligent thing, can look at the human cell, look at DNA, look at how a cell functions and say, I see the fingerprint of a Creator here. We see the fingerprint of the Creator in the entire universe. And it's a statement of faith to say that that fingerprint is simply the appearance of creation and not the appearance of intelligent design and not the reality thereof. The empirical approach says there is a Creator because you can see what He did. I didn't intend to get into intelligent design theory here tonight, but we just did. And we'll see more of that as we go into the rest of the creation story in chapter 1.
Copyright by Dr. Gregory S. Neal, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.revneal.org. That's www.revneal.org. This program was produced by Dr. Greg Neal.